Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunleary.net.
Yeah, welcome along to Monday Night's Football Show. It's Richie McCormack here with you for the next hour of football chat. We're looking back on the weekend when Liverpool got their groove back most firmly, and it looks like we're zeroing in on a Manchester City versus Liverpool title race. Where have we seen that before? It's also transfer deadline day, deals ongoing as we speak tonight. Liverpool signing Ben Davies from Preston North End for an initial £500,000. Seb Vandenberg going on loan in the other direction. Troy Parrott cancelling his loan deal at Millwall earlier today. He instead has dropped down another division to head to Ipswich until the end of the season under the stewardship of Paul Lambert. Conor Shaughnessy as well leaving Leeds today for Rochdale. And in the past few moments, we're just hearing that Bournemouth have accepted bids from both Everton and Fulham for their striker Josh King. So it looks like he's on the move tonight too. And on the continent there we have as well, Nice are about to snap up Jean-Claire Tobido from Barcelona on loan initially. And it looks like that deal could be made permanent in the summer. Delighted to say, I'm joined on the line to look back on the weekend and indeed the goings on of tonight, because it very much is a live situation, even if we don't have a game, by Pat Nevin. Good evening, Pat.
Good evening, Richie. How are you doing?
Not too bad. I'm curious. I know when you were in your playing days, transfer deadline day was something a little bit more demure and happened in the middle of the spring without many people noticing. But I was just wondering if you've ever been kind of heading towards a deadline day and being on the verge of a transfer and what that might be like.
Right. I'm going to tell you a quick story then. You'll like this. I was it was the end of my career. I was playing for Motherwell, but I was also chief executive there. And the transfer deadline was coming to an end. But we had a goalkeeper that was cost a lot of money, but we needed to get rid of him, basically. We needed the money. But Manchester United also needed a goalkeeper for their European, next round of European competitions. So they had 2 days left. Fortunately for me, it snowed the day before. So I became unavailable for an entire day and then managed to get all the way up to 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I pushed the deadline's 5 without speaking to them, knowing that our goalkeeper, Andy Gorham, was down in Manchester with a pen poised. And when Sir Alec came on asking, can we do the deal? And I went, yeah, how much are you offering? And they went, we thought it was a free deal. I went, what? So they had an hour and I knew they had nowhere else to go, because I'd kind of filibustered for 2 whole days. And in the last hour I said, no, you may give us some money. So I managed to get £250,000, I think.
That's not bad going.
It's not bad going for mucking about with a wee bit of snow in Scotland. And you try every trick in the book. And you, to some degree, you need to. What Sir Alec and Man United didn't know at the time was, had they gone to 10 to 5, I would have said, have them for free. We actually can't afford the wages anymore. That's the deal.
That's, yeah, because we look, my memory of Andy Gorham appearing at Old Trafford, because everybody obviously would have known him to a degree from his stint at Hibs, but then obviously on into his Rangers days was, I guess, when he was most prominent in our eyes. So he kind of reappeared from out of nowhere when he was between the sticks at Old Trafford. I'd forgotten completely that he'd come from Motherwell at the time. Yeah, yeah.
He actually was incredible even then. To be fair, he didn't have a great time at Manchester United, but he was one of those goalkeepers where, you know, just in training every day, he would do at least one thing that was impossible. And you'll go, what? How did you? He really was, as you know, as a saver of shots, like just unbelievably elastic. He was world class for a period of time.
Yeah, that period in the 90s, I think people almost forget the level that Rangers were playing at, particularly in Europe. I mean, they were a side that, you know, justifiably got to the latter stages of the European Cup, the Champions League, as it was kind of transitioning into then. And he was key to them doing that post Chris Woods.
I mean, they had some team. There was lots of stories around them. I'm actually writing a wee bit about them at the moment, Andy Gorham, and the stories that follow him around were incredible. The thing is, he was a lovable, daft guy most of the time. The stories that followed him around were absolutely incredible. And I was fortunate because before that I played with Neville Southall, so some of the best goalkeeping saves I've ever seen in my life usually happened at training with those two guys. But you're right, Rangers were fantastic, but my family have got a complete ban on mentioning Glasgow Rangers at the moment because it's just not a lot of fun. Actually, I was out running today in St Abbs, beautiful sort of cliffside area of near where I live here in the Scottish Borders. Yep. And I ran by a guy and he shouted, "Oh, I know," because there's a phrase that's always said to me, "I know your brother Tommy," right? Because my brother Tommy's better known than me around the world, right? And as I went away, he goes, "You not fancy the Celtic job?" And I went, "No." He goes, "Well, I might as well just throw myself off this cliff," and he started walking towards this cliff. They're no happy, the Celtic fans, at the moment, and understandably so.
Yeah, it's a bit of, because we've obviously seen in the past few days, Peter Lowell is heading out the door. I don't think necessarily he's going to be mourned when he heads out in the summer by Celtic fans. We're seeing Ben Davies opt for Liverpool over the chance of joining Celtic, and you can kind of see why a player would make that decision, not just because Liverpool are in the position that they are, but because Celtic seem to be a madhouse at the minute.
And that's the problem because, I mean, if Lenny actually go, you look at who's going to be the next manager. It's a hard job, you know, because Rangers have got their mojo together a little bit. Steven Gerrard has actually done a very, very good job. You would think this season's gone. And if you didn't think it before the weekend there, you'll certainly think it now after Celtic lost to St Mirren. I was doing a comedy show over here in the UK, Fighting Talk with Colin Murray.
Yeah.
And I said, it doesn't matter. My line was, it doesn't matter how much you pray, you can get those rosary beads down to the string, you have no chance this year. You're absolutely stuffed. And I'm allowed to say that because of my background. And it's sad times for Celtic because, you know, they came so close to the 10 in a row. And it's this mythical thing. You know, I remember watching the Celtic win the 9 in a row in the 60s and 70s and then played against Rangers. And I've quite a wee story about that. They were going for 10 in a row. And I was playing against them the day they blew it because I was playing for Kilmarnock. And we beat Rangers at Ibrox 1-0. And it stuffed them. They had two games to go. And had they won that, they'd have gone on 1-10 in a row. So there are certain pubs in Glasgow where I am never allowed to buy a drink my wife ever again. There are other pubs I'm never allowed in yet.
There's certain ones you're treasured in. You know, you can just sit at the end of the bar and go, "My name is Pat Nevin and my glass is empty." And you'll be sorted out in jig time. Be no problem at all. I want to move on to the Premier League action of the weekend because like this Premier League season's mad and it's daft. We've kind of covered that, you know, innumerable times already. We've gone through the amount of teams that have been top of this league so far, and I think we're approaching half of the teams, more or less, since September, between now and September, have been top of the league. Manchester City gone 3 points clear. They seem to have gotten their groove back, and very much so over the course of the last couple of weeks. But this Liverpool team and the last two games that we've seen them put together, those back-to-back games in London, first against Tottenham and then now against West Ham, you would have been forgiven for thinking that for periods in both games that it was the same Liverpool that we'd seen over the Christmas, the turn of the year, that they were struggling to put together moves from the back and that they were struggling to get the fullbacks into the game the way they used to, and therefore their forwards weren't firing. But it has clicked in both of those games, and when it has clicked, they've looked like the side of old. And I say of old, I mean of 12 months ago to 9 months ago, really.
They're well capable of doing it in any game. I mean, sometimes you can actually get a little bit carried away from it because you remember the moments, and they usually involve Salah, and you think, wow, it's all back again. But then you think about it, actually, there were bits of it that weren't absolutely brilliant. There are going to be difficulties for Liverpool, and we've been expecting this for some time. As I've often said, you know, I thought this would happen a year ago, but they've done brilliantly, hold on as long as they have held on. But because of the limitations of the size of the squad, and it's noticeable today, that's what they're looking for, a little bit more strength and depth in the defensive areas. So, you know, I'm not surprised that they've had the wobble. There might be other wobbles between now and the end of the season. Do I think they'll win every game and play brilliantly between now and the end of the season? No, I don't actually think that. I think it's just that much harder now. And you bring in Europe into it again with that amount of games together. They're going to suffer. But then most of the teams at the top, including like the likes of Manchester United, are going to suffer in the same sorts of ways. So it's and of course Manchester City. The thing is with Manchester City, they have got they seem to have a really good depth of squad there as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if Manchester City, you talk about Liverpool, but I would expect Man City to be the ones who are probably the ones to, I know they're ahead just now, but from what I've seen them recently, and I've been to see them a couple of times, and I'm going to see them on Thursday night when they play against Burnley. When they're clicking at the moment, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely fantastic. But it's not all the time. I was at the recent Brighton game. Brilliant first 45 minutes. Awful second 45 minutes. Pep made some terrible tactical decisions as well. And they were obviously bad because he then changed them after about 25 minutes. So it's up in the air. I'm not going for the fact that it's the both of them and nobody else. I will not write off United yet. I just cannot do that. There's too much quality. They're having a bad couple of games and you write them off. But you do so at your peril.
That's the one thing that we've seen about this season. It kind of brings into sharp focus how a lot of people view the game, in that they are willing to make decisions, set in stone, concrete decisions about teams, about players, after one or two performances. And that's based on seasons that we've seen over the course of the last couple of years, whereby two teams, perhaps one, dominate throughout the duration at the top of the table, your usual team scrap it out at the bottom. It's because this season is far less binary. We've seen a lot less reason to lean on those usual arguments of, oh, well, they've had two bad games, their season's done for. This season has completely thrown all of that out the window, and it's almost given us an old school kind of season whereby you're not going to get 90 to 100 points. You're not going to go 70-odd% of the season unbeaten. You're going to lose games, but it's trying to, you know, win the games that are winnable and get over the line as often as you can, which is something that United have done this season. It's something that Man City did against Sheffield United. You just do enough to get over the line. You don't have to win every game 4-5, 6-0, putting on a Brazil 1982 show the whole way.
You're right. We've got sucked into the narrative of the last couple of years, saying that's the new normal. It's not. It's not the new normal. It was a period of time that was extraordinary because you had two fabulous teams that were a lot better than the rest for a variety of reasons. I mean, a number of teams were in transition for a good period of time there, or falling off the edge of a cliff after being pretty good. But you take it a little bit further back, and it wasn't like that. And people should have realised this. Remember Leicester? I mean, come on. People should have realised you can get upsets just because the last few haven't been like that. So I'm like everybody else, I'm absolutely loving it. And so many games, you think you've sorted your head out, and then Big Sam goes to Liverpool and you think, eh? And then it's every team's got a game like that. I mean, Spurs, I have to say, I thought they looked great. Then Harry Kane gets injured and suddenly you're thinking, actually, really? Are you sure? Like, two defeats in a row, one of them against Brighton. So don't write anyone. The big problem for Manchester City, and they're the ones you would concern us at most about, because they're on the great run just now. Mm. And when you start looking at their stats, it's only two defeats, I believe, this season.
Yeah.
So, you know, people saying they weren't having a great time, well, in actual fact, they usually had games in hand, and they weren't really losing that many games. The ones they lost kind of stuck out. But the one for them is, you just think, if they lose De Bruyne for any length of time, that could be the clincher. But, you know, they've been without him a couple of times now, and they seem to be doing well. And a couple of others have really stood up to the plate, really. You know, Silva was great the other day, Bernardo, obviously. But Gundogan recently, I'm sure all our listeners, and you've thought to yourself, how good has he been recently? I mean, he's absolutely stunned me. I mean, you know, he was a good player. But recently, he's just like, I'll just take centre stage now. And I have to say, I did not see that coming with him. I thought he was very much a junior member, a junior partner of all those creative players. But he's really stepped up to the plate. And that's the difference with City just now. Even without De Bruyne, you know, Foden might do it one day. I mean, the last game I went to see them, Foden was the best player by a country mile. You know, so they've got so many that can just step up and do it.
Yeah, I mean, Gundogan, like, when he was signed by Manchester City, I guess this is the player that we thought Manchester City were signing, because he had put in, you know, a few good seasons for Borussia Dortmund. It was key to them doing so well, both in the Bundesliga and then in Europe too. I'm trying to think what would be the catalyst for this season for him. And one of the things that kind of jumps out at me is that there's no David Silva there. And that means that he's not just competing for the same space when the two of them are in the starting 11, but the fact that he has taken on that mantle now that Silva's gone entirely, he's pretty much taken that weight on his shoulders and decided to run with it, and has made a good case for staying in that side and being one of their key players.
Well, for a period of time, you know, obviously Silva did it for a decade, which is pretty damn good, and Gundogan's doing it for a wee while now. But I think you're right. I think it's partially what you're suggesting there, you know, that, you know, the mantle has to be passed on somewhere. And was it going to be Bernardo Silva? Was it going to be Foden? Was it all going to fall on De Bruyne to replace what David Silva was doing? And I suppose Gundogan wasn't the one you expected. Part of it's a dead simple thing, which is playground stuff. That other guy was getting the ball all the time, and you weren't. It can be as simple as that. We're not playing in teams where if the guy on the other side's like unbelievable and has the ball all the time, well, you can be the best form of all, but you're only getting 10% of the ball. I watched this for years with the guy I felt most sorry for in world football for this, for about a decade, was Willian. So he goes and plays for Chelsea, then Hazard comes. Every time you look up and you've got them two on, you know who you're going to give the ball to. You're going to give it to Hazard, right? And then he goes and plays for Brazil. And exactly the same thing happens there. Are you going to give it to Willian? Are you going to give it to Neymar? You're going to give it to Neymar. Yeah. And that's what happened all the time. And it can happen with, you know, certain teams. They play through certain structures of certain guys. And if you're Gundogan, you actually, you're kind of getting the scraps to some degree, even when you're on the pitch. But you're right. He's not getting the scraps at the moment. He's central. And even with De Bruyne out, it kind of almost helps him a wee bit, because with no Silva, David Silva, no De Bruyne, okay, I can step up there. But more importantly, I'm getting more ball. And with more ball, I'll be able to do more with it.
Yeah, they've got players to come back as well. We think of when eventually Sergio Aguero kind of comes back to full fitness and gets, you know, shakes the COVID stuff. He'll be another threat to add to their attack over the next while. Where do you see their weaknesses, though, for City? You mentioned Pep's proclivity to kind of overthink a game. We saw it in Europe last year, last season in the latter stages of the Champions League. We've seen it on occasion in the Premier League this time around. He has a tendency to overthink and make things a little bit too complicated for himself. Is that what's going to be their downfall? Or are you just essentially, like everybody else, waiting for them to go through their injury period, which, given the way this season has gone for everybody, they're going to at some point?
They've had one or two already, and big ones. And Aguero, as you say, it's been a long-term one, you know, so that's a big one. Interestingly, he tried to make a point, you know, with Jesus. You know, he played him in the left wing in the game recently against Brighton. Honestly, it was a ridiculous effort. He was awful. He was beyond awful. I don't know if he wasn't trying or not, but he was awful, right? So, but Pep stuck with him just too long. You know, if I can see it after 10 minutes that guy, A, doesn't want to be there, B, can't really play it very well, certainly not to the level that Foden and all the rest of them can. So that answers your point a wee bit, that there is that stubbornness. We all know it's there with Pep. He wants to some degree to say, well, I know better than all of you. And most of the time he does. But every now and again he doesn't. And, you know, what you're seeing is, and it's a great thing when I talk to people like yourselves, you know, and Irish people in Irish media, you just say it like it is. It's like, the emperor ain't got new clothes on. You're going to tell him he's not got new clothes on. And that's what I love to hear, because a lot of people do stand back from actually saying that. And when he does make the mistakes, certainly, it shows up. He needs to, the tiny wee bit he has to get rid of, it's just that, you know, being a little bit stubborn when something's quite clearly, obviously not working. Other than that, you look at defensively, looking pretty good there. I mean, Stones has been an absolute revelation recently. Yeah, really different physique, standing, just walking past him recently. Just looks like a different guy. You honestly would think, are you John Stones' big brother then? Because he just looks one of them more powerful, you know?
Part of that is gym work, I think, and part of that is confidence. Like, there was an interesting line from, like, it's a couple of divisions down, but Carl Robinson, the Oxford manager, was talking about Luke McNally, who's moved from St. Pat's over here to Oxford. And he said he met him in the car park the morning he signed. And he goes, what height are you? And McNally goes, I think I'm 6'2", 6'3". And he goes, you're 6'4". He goes, you put your shoulders back, you walk like you're 6'4", you talk like you're 6'4", you carry yourself on the pitch like you're 6'4". You are, for all intents and purposes, 6'4". And I think there's been a bit of that with Stones, particularly having Diaz settle in so well beside him. And they formed a particularly good duo over the last couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, that absolutely helps. But that thing of that physicality now, you know, it does something else to you. It's kind of hard to explain. It's like, have you ever talked to a boxer? Yes, you have talked to many boxers, right? There's something in there, isn't there? They're different from the rest of us. there's a kind of look, we kind of just look at you and kind of go, yeah, you know, as if to say, I could kill you at any point in time, you know. They've all got it. The best ones, they just got this look, this kind of aura that's from their body out, right? Mm. And some players have kind of just got it. And John Stones did not have that. Absolutely had none of that at all. He was wanting to play pretty all the time, which I've nothing against because he's a really good footballer. But see, when he knew or has learned that he can add that other side to it, he's just a different guy. You're right. He's 2 inches taller. He's also about 3 inches wider and stronger and a few stones heavier. Mm. But it is. It's in there. It's absolutely in there. My dad, his thing, he was a boxer. So and I can know what that thing is, you know, when you've got it inside it and you know you are more powerful than the person you're against. It's very old school stuff, but it didn't have to work.
Mm. The intimidatory factor. How do you think that's going to factor in? Because we've got the game coming up this Sunday between Liverpool and Man City. Like I said, perhaps I'm wrong, that we do look like we're zeroing in on a title race between the two again, but it kind of, you know, counteracts the point I made earlier on, which says that we're looking and far too used to looking at this season in a kind of binary sense. Will there be much to read into this as regards who comes away victorious, being champions elect or not?
We are getting on a bit in the season now. We're past halfway now, right? Mm. And just sort of looking at a league table there, in Liverpool, they're 4 points behind, but obviously City have got a game in hand. So if you said that was 7, if City won that and went 10 ahead of Liverpool, even in this mad season, you would think that's pushing it a wee bit, because City have got Burnley, as I say, on Thursday. To have a kind of 10-point gap going into, you know, well into the second part of the season, it's not impossible, but that is a mighty, mighty number to overhaul for a team that looks as if they're just getting into their stride just now. Not impossible, but I would much rather be Man City than Liverpool. So read into it limited amounts if Liverpool win. Read out it a lot if Man City win.
It's not the nicest of warm-ups, though, considering they have to play Burnley on Thursday night for Man City. I mean, there's a side that can, in terms of boxers and in terms of, you know, throwing your weight around, Burnley can very much do that. And particularly they're back too with Tarkowski and me. They're two brutes who really let you know you've been in the game.
Yeah, to push the boxing analogy a wee bit further,
let's stretch it out to the nth degree, Pat. Let's go. Let's see that elastic band snap. Come on.
Okay. They played against Chelsea and I watched them, and they did float like butterflies and they did sting like butterflies as well. They were awful. It just looked as if they were nowhere near it. They didn't have anything really to offer going forward. The interesting thing, Chelsea have played 2 games under Tuchel. They have had precisely 0 shots on target against them in 2 games, and one of them obviously was the Burnley game, and they did look really quite insipid. So they don't often look that way. They were just outplayed and, you know, just outthought. They definitely were outthought tactically, and that was an interesting thing. And I think that a number of teams will have watched what happened to Burnley there when you played that kind of really quite unusual system that Tuchel played against them, and they had no idea how to do it. I mean, honestly, looking at the right wing there, Hudson-Odoi could have been playing with slippers on and we still created mayhem, because there was just nobody to mark them because of the way that the game has been stretched in a different way. And I think a lot of people have looked at Burnley, and I wonder if John Dyche will think, right, I better dump this 4-4-2 for 1 or 2 games, because I think that was a wee bit found out in that game. So they have to win or take part in the battle. But it's one of those ones, if Man City scored, that could be a foregone conclusion. But I'm looking forward to going there.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact that I'm going to freeze because it's going to be snowing, as it always seems to be in Burnley.
Yeah, you've got the worst of it the past while over there. I want to touch on Chelsea, actually, because this time last week we were talking about the impending arrival of Thomas Tuchel. If we're going to compare him to Pep, like you mentioned about Pep there, Pep on occasion seems like he's one of these stars who wants to settle into normality more often than not. Thomas Tuchel strikes me as being the kind of guy who is determined to let everybody know he's the smartest guy in the room. How accurate an appraisal do you think that is after 2 games?
He will be more intelligent looking if he acts less intelligent. It's one of those classic ones. The most intelligent people you know are the ones that dumb it down a wee bit and don't show you how smart they are. Mm. The ones that are trying to show you how... The truly ignorant person is the one who actually thinks he knows everything. And that's absolutely a truism in this world. I think Tuchel, for just the bits that I've seen, I think he's learned a little bit for, you know, the things he's gone through, where he's been, particularly at PSG, you know, falling out with the disagreements they had, particularly with Leonardo. I think that made a little bit of difference. And there are certain things that are worth falling your sword for and certain things that aren't. Now, he's at Chelsea now. There's a hell of a lot of swords around, so you better be careful, mate. Don't do that. Make sure that you try and get the best out of that group. And it's intriguing to see what he does. But he's come in smiling, laughing, trying to be everybody's friend just now. But Chelsea's just such a weird place, you know. So I don't know if this is true. I had a quote the other day. I'm going to have to look up. I should have looked up beforehand. Somebody told me Frank Lampard was Roman Abramovich's fourth longest-serving manager. That's brilliant.
I wouldn't say far off, yeah. Because like we were talking last week, like Lampard, I think, because I did the tot, and it depends who you regard as permanent and who you regard as temporary, and your Goose Hiddinks and Avram Grants and all that kind of are halfway houses. But I think Lampard played under something like a dozen different reigns while he was at Chelsea. So he essentially helped create the culture by succeeding in the face of the constant carousel of managers. They succeeded along with that, and probably it helped them to a degree as well. So Thomas Tuchel will be under no illusions about what awaits him. I mean, the fact that he's only signed an 18-month contract, I think, kind of tells you everything about both sides' expectations heading into this relationship.
Yeah, there's upsides and downsides to that methodology. It seems to have gotten the most successful time in that club's history. So, A, it works. B, it's the most expensive way to do it. But he seems to have a few quid. So what is the answer to that? The downsides, which I always mention to everyone, and you know, it's only came very obvious because the new manager, there's no reason why he should develop players. Absolutely no reason. Why should he do that? He's not going to be there. So that's why you lose Salah. That's why you lose De Bruyne. And that's why, if they're not careful, they might lose one or two, such as wee Billy Gilmore, who is pretty special and getting better all the time. If they do that and let those sort of players slip through their fingers, you mean, I honestly suspect if Billy Gilmore became available, Pep Guardiola would grab him in a millisecond. Absolutely would, because he's exactly the type of player that he loves to have in his team. So it's one of those ones where, but in the end, the long term, does that matter greatly to Chelsea, to Tuchel, as long as they get back up challenging? Yeah. So even then, they're a wee distance off just now. But you're not going to write them off getting top four either. Absolutely not. I don't think they're not going to win the league, but top four, wouldn't be surprised.
Would you presume that he's eyeing up the Champions League? Because you look at, you know, what's to come later in February now, later in this month, they'll be playing Atletico Madrid in the last 16, who are going pretty well in Spain. But you know, it's one of these things that if you size a tie up, like, you know, the way Chelsea have the opportunity to do, when you consider that, okay, the league is out of reach, we're playing for a top four position this year, but really we have a decent chance to go and attack a cup, and Tuchel would have a hell of a point to prove in this competition to go in there in his first 6 months and do a job in the Champions League.
Yeah, and he'll know a number of things. The guys that he's got there are capable of being a very good team. They had that 17-game unbeaten run. That last game they had, Sevilla, 4-0 away from home. You could almost play, and that was I think it was 10 different players from the week before that they played. So he knows he's got a depth of squad. I think a lot of people were talking about Tuchel coming in and, you know, getting the best out of Werner and Havertz. And yeah, there's a bit of that. But realistically, they're looking at the Champions League. They're thinking, this guy knows, you know, European football. He's been in there often enough. So, you know, if anyone's capable of doing it with his, he may well be the one who is available, who's most capable of doing it for Chelsea. So, yeah, they may well be looking at getting as far as possible in the Champions League. Getting by Atleti is going to be difficult. A bit of a shame for Chelsea. It's a bad draw, considering they won their group quite easily. But certainly it'll be on his mind that he's got to do that. But he's got a lot to learn in a short period of time. He still doesn't know all the players. But he fell on something the weekend, which I bet you he spotted, which I don't think anyone did before. I don't think Frank did. I don't think anyone did. And it was amazing to see. Hudson-Odoi and Mount are telepathic. And I hadn't noticed it before. It's really weird because Hudson-Odoi had always played one wing or the other wing to Mount, and they'd never sort of linked together. He played a system where they happened to be playing together. It's astonishing that the understanding and the work, and it's just one of those things where sometimes you got to be lucky. And I just think he got a bit lucky with that one. If he gets one or two others that click like that, you know, we wouldn't be surprised if he went on a pretty decent run, but they're still outsiders without a shadow.
Before you go, we had Marcus Rashford come out again at the weekend tweeting to say that he'd been the victim of racist abuse on Twitter. We've seen other players, Reece James at Chelsea, you know, has been pretty vocal about it as well. We saw what happened to two lads at Manchester United last week, Anthony Martial and Axel Tuanzebe. It's a problem. People have framed this as a football issue. It's not. There's clearly something bigger going on here that needs tackling. And I'm wondering how football can set about trying to... It's not a problem you're going to rectify, but it's a problem you can try and work against. How does football work against this at the moment?
Well, the lovely thing is, you know, looking at it from someone who's been involved in anti-racism causes in football since 1983, right? Mm. To see how it's changed. And you notice that the players aren't aiming it towards the clubs as much these days. It's aimed out with. It's aimed towards, you know, parts of society. It's aimed towards Twitter or whatever social media platforms they're doing just now. And although it's maybe not stylish to say it, that's a step forward in itself, because you have to get, it's all about education, right? So you have to educate people what is and isn't acceptable in a culture. But Twitter and Facebook, etc., they're just free-for-alls. Nobody could have an effect on them. And we've all been abused. Every one of us, for a variety of reasons, we've been abusing Twitter. I'll mention Twitter just now because it's the most obvious one. But there are others, right? And they could not give a stuff. They absolutely couldn't give a stuff. No effect whatsoever. It wasn't big enough to affect them. Nothing seemed big enough. Suddenly, footballers, for the first time ever, following Rashford, Sterling and a number of others, the platform that they've got worldwide now is that big that finally you actually can get to these people at Twitter, because they have got the wherewithal and they've got the finances to deal with it. They have never bothered to do it before. And the excitement for me is I'm hearing people turn not on, yeah you're going to turn on the morons, yeah, we're all going to do that. And we try that, but it's like, it was an old phrase, was it Dickens, the poor you will always have with you. Well, you know, the morons you will always have with you. They're going to be some there anyway, and they're going to pop up now and again. But Twitter, any platform like that, they will go by the bottom line. If their bottom line is now being attacked by footballers who are so massive now on a planetary-wide scale, that's the thing that's going to have a bigger effect. And I'm so delighted. Over the weekend, you know, people that Marcus have talked about it, which is fantastic, and Reece James and a number of us and the managers come out. Suddenly Twitter looks like mud and the best place in the world that you want to be seen well. And they will change. They will change. And I can't believe I'm saying it, because I never, ever thought they would. And it's a dark moment just now. But now and again, just before the light, there's this the real darkness. I've got a real great hope that we're never going to get rid of this, but we're just going to turn a little corner now where these people are going to actually start doing something about it. And I'm so excited about it.
Yeah, a little bit of responsibility wouldn't go a long way. Pat, thanks so much for joining us tonight. Thanks for taking time out to speak to us.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Pat Nevin, more after this.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunleary.net.
With you until 10 o'clock, and transfer deadline day ongoing. Liverpool signing Ben Davies from Preston North End for an initial $500,000. Interesting one to pop up over the last half hour or so. Takumi Minamino, the Liverpool forward, has been requested by Southampton. They're looking to take him on loan until the end of the season. And Celtic have snapped up the Everton fullback, Jonjo Kenny, also on loan until the end of this campaign. If anything major happens, particularly on the front of Ozan Kabak from Schalke to Liverpool, we'll let you know before 10 o'clock. But joining us on the line from The Sun is Martin Lipton to talk through, I guess, what's going on with Tottenham, or not, as it were, at the moment, because it seemed just over a month ago we were talking about Tottenham in terms of potential title contenders, about Jose Mourinho having his mojo back, and very quickly that is all blown away. Martin, that defeat to Brighton kind of spoke volumes of where Spurs have found themselves in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it was utterly appalling, wasn't it, from start to finish. There was no impetus, there was no energy, there was no drive. I could say there was no nothing, because there was nothing there. It was a very, very poor performance from start to finish. They were mind-blowingly awful.
We want to look at a fairly insular point on this. Matt Doherty arrived at Tottenham in the summer. What was it, 15 million quid, taking a step up from Wolves up to what's been traditionally been a top six side, top four side over the last couple of years. And we thought, all right, this is going to go really well, and he's going to, you know, be ahead of Seamus Coleman in terms of the starting right back position for Ireland. It seems to have gone off the boil for him over the course of the last couple of weeks. He's been used at left wing back. He's been left out of the side. I don't know if it's a case where Mourinho's unsure of him or unsure of how best to utilise his defence. Where does it lie for you?
It's a bit of all of it, isn't it? I think he didn't play particularly well. He came back from the internationals at the start of the season looking a little bit leggy, I thought. He didn't look right. He didn't play well in those opening games. He was signed because they were desperate to get rid of Aurier. They didn't sell Aurier. Aurier then ended up being first choice until he throws his toys out of the pram against Liverpool at half-time last week. But even then, you know, he goes without him again at Brighton, playing with a back three, which you would have thought was arguably the setup most conducive to using Doherty, as that's what he'd been used to at Wolves. Well, I think you should be able to play the right back in a four in any event. Something clearly is awry in the relationship. I'm not saying they've had a fallout, just he doesn't appear to have the trust and faith in Doherty as a player that you'd expect, given that he was very much his prime signing, and for a while it looked as though he might be his only signing of the summer as well, until that late flurry with a few more coming in. I think it would be a surprise and disappointment to Doherty, but also the Spurs, because they were looking at him to be an important, integral member of the starting lineup, and for whatever reason, it hasn't happened. And he hasn't, let's be honest, he hasn't impressed. There have been a series of weak performances, you know, a needless red card the other week against Leeds when he didn't need to do anything, the game was dead, why get yourself involved then? Things like that don't help.
The Aurier thing at half-time at Anfield certainly doesn't help either. How bad is that relationship at the moment? How, I don't want to say cancerous, but those kind of incidents don't necessarily happen in a vacuum. There can be players who side with people who take those kind of stands against a manager or against a situation. Is this rectifiable? Are there other players who fall into that Aurier camp at the moment?
I wouldn't have thought too many. I mean, they were, as I said, in the summer, they were desperate to get rid of him. Mm. He was the biggest menace in lockdown, wasn't he? He didn't seem to understand that rules apply to association footballers as well as the literal people, as it were. Mm. And they were really hacked off. And they were looking for anyone they could punt him out to in March, April, May, June. I mean, it got that bad. And they couldn't find a buyer. And he was then did quite well. And to be fair, he played very well for a period through the autumn. He was excellent, to be fair. Although you always feel that there's a horrendous blunder in him every game, because he has that sort of mind, you know, brainstorm sessions where he just loses it and does something really silly. So I think it's just general frustration at the way they're collectively playing. It blew out. He lost it. Apparently, there was an almighty row in the dressing room, which was said to have destabilised all the other players as well, because they were trying to play football and get themselves back on track, having conceded with the last kick of the first half against Liverpool. And it ended up in something that's got clearly serious, because he was left out of the squad altogether. But of course, if he's not sold, and he's not going to be sold, because they've got, you know, half an hour to go before it shuts, then they're going to have to deal with him. They're not going to take him out of the squad, because they haven't got too much cover. So they're going to have to find a way of reintegrating him into the system and the first 11 at some point. But how long will that last? We don't know. I still, if I was to harbour a guess, I suggest they will try and move him on in the summer again. But they did that last summer and failed miserably.
Yeah, they've kind of got, I guess, lost their the window's literally closing in the next hour and a half or so. So we've kind of missed an opportunity to move him on in the winter. This little slip, this subsidence, I guess you call it, in the past couple of weeks, beginning with that 3-1 defeat to Liverpool, it's quite like the injury to Harry Kane has gone pretty much hand in hand with this as well. It's not going to help the upcoming games when you see they have the likes of Chelsea, they've got West Brom, Everton, Man City, and then back into Europe against Wolfsburg over the next few weeks. Like, it's a tricky period coming, and if you have a side who are leaking goals, as Tottenham have begun to do, and then aren't scoring them because you're striker in chief is out, you're in a really, really grim position for the next couple of weeks.
Well, it's a bit hard to say they're leaking goals. They conceded three against Liverpool, who on their day are the best attacking team in the in the country,
yeah.
and they conceded one against Brighton. They haven't. I mean, I think that only two teams have conceded fewer goals than Spurs this season in the Premier League. So it's hard to criticise them for leaking goals. They are conceding the same goal too often, I think, at the moment, and they need to sort it out. They need to get a settled back line. It keeps them swapping, chopping and changing. I don't think that benefits. The trouble is, the whole way they've been playing is based on one man being key to it. That key's not there, and nothing works, and therefore they've got to find a way of playing in the short term without Kane. Now, if that means playing Vinicius, who, to be fair, when he came on against Brighton, looked as if he was more mobile and gave them some shape and definition, which might be an improvement. He hasn't played enough football since they signed him in September. He got that hat-trick against Marine, but that doesn't really count. He's got a couple in his debut, you know, one of his early goals in Europe, but not enough goals. Hasn't scored a Premier League goal yet. He needs to start firing very quickly. And now, assuming that Dele doesn't go, and that looks to be the case, got to get him back into the team or into the squad or involved in some way, because it's a complete waste of time and talent, him not being involved at the moment.
That seems to be the case with a bunch of players now at the minute, though, at Tottenham. Like we mentioned it with Doherty, who's, you know, his form has kind of, you know, led into that a little bit. You've got, as we mentioned, Aurier, who can be a passenger. Now, Dele Alli, who's on big money, was one of their key players, and we're now struggling to get him into the side. And then you arrive at the massive exclamation mark that is Gareth Bale. I mean, everybody looked at this move when it came to pass, thinking, all right, yeah, Spurs have got him on an initial loan. Maybe Jose can get a song out of him. At what point do we cut bait here and say that this has been a disaster? Because that's not the guy we saw 3-4 years ago playing for Real Madrid that we've seen in the past couple of weeks playing for Tottenham.
I don't think disaster is fair, but I think disappointment is absolutely fair. Disaster would be hasn't played, hasn't scored, hasn't involved. Well, that's not the case because he has played, he has scored a few goals, he has been involved, he has shown signs of being, you know, just the other week against, it was only Wickham, but last Monday against Wickham, you thought, hang on, he's on the way here, he seems to be finding his feet. There was a bit of that dash. He scored one, he could have scored three or four, and yet he did nothing when he came in against Liverpool where the game was dead. He was very poor yesterday. And you start looking and think, God, blimey, what's happened? Have his legs gone? Has all the injuries, has the timeout taken its toll? And unfortunately, you'd have to say at the moment it looks as though it has, which means that he'll go back in June having made limited impression, apart from on the bank balance. And then what does he do at Madrid? Because they don't want him. And it's not ideal. And also it means for Wales, he's not going to be the player they need him to be for, if it takes place, and I think it will, the Euros in the summer. So that's a devastating blow for them and for him, because I'm sure he went back to Spurs hoping to make it work, hoping to show Madrid were wrong, hoping to prove to himself that he could cut the mustard at the highest level. And thus far, no one can say he's done that. It's been deeply disappointing.
Is it a mentality thing? I mean, when you've got a player who was, and he seemed not entirely delighted, but at least content enough to take a place on the bench or take a place in the squad at Madrid because he was on 600,000 a week or whatever it was, and then wanted to engineer a move to China. And as plenty of people have mentioned over the weekend, you only go to China for one reason, and that's to earn cash, and it certainly isn't to compete for trophies and to play top-level football. It's a hard thing to bring your mind back around to being the competitive force that you would have been 5-6 years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for any player, I guess, when you've won everything that you can as a club player, and he did, in terms of Champions League 3-4 times, including scoring the winning goal a couple of times, winning La Liga, winning those trophies, taking as the main man Wales to their first tournament in 50 years, 60 years, you can understand why there comes a point, if you're not being involved for as long as he was not involved, that you think, you know what, if I don't need this anymore. And that's a real shame. And you know, the hope was that the move to Spurs would, you know, allow him to recapture that mojo and make him really be a version of Gareth Bale. He's not going to be the Gareth Bale 23-24 because he's not 23 or 24 anymore. You know, your body changes and so does he, and his has changed. But even in the last 18 months, looking for Wales, he's still been their key man. At the moment, he wouldn't be, would he? You know, I can't see him being a certain starter, even for his country, when he's been the first name on the team sheet for the last decade.
We were talking to Pat Nevin just before you came on there, Martin. We were talking about social media. I got slaughtered by a bunch of Welsh people before when I talked about the Bale move and the fact that it wasn't working out and that maybe he wasn't the player he was. They will tell you that in a Wales jersey, he's a different guy. There's that glint in the eye is there, that willingness to take a man on is there again. There's something switches in him when he does play for Wales that just doesn't seem to be able to be recaptured at club level.
Well, we don't know, do we? Because he hasn't played enough to see. I hope he's great for Wales in March because I think he needs that for himself.
Mm.
But at the moment, if you're Ryan Giggs and you're looking at his performances, you're going to be deeply worried because your hopes of getting through to the knockout stage, I wouldn't say they're utterly dependent on Gareth Bale, but they're significantly dependent on Gareth Bale, given you've got a group with, you know, Switzerland, Italy and Turkey. You're going to need Bale to be important and key and playing well to have any chance of not finishing bottom, you know, of getting through to the knockout stage.
Mm. It's such a mad season. It's actually impossible to call, you know, which way it's going to be. But if we're going to project that Spurs perhaps continue on this path and don't make Champions League football, is there another season for Mourinho there, or do you reckon they'll have to look elsewhere?
I really don't know. If they keep on playing with such lack of intensity and urgency, the only thing that would keep him in the job is the contract and the fact there's no fans in the stadium, because you can imagine it would have been pretty miserable and they'd have been allowing their displeasure to be known. And we know how Mourinho reacts to adverse comments from his own supporters, not necessarily very well. Then again, does Daniel Levy want to pay what I assume will be a huge compensation fee at a time when Spurs' revenues and income have been significantly, drastically reduced through the fact that they're missing out on £6 million every home game through the turnstile, that they're not in the Champions League, which is another £40 million. But the Premier League income, they've still got to pay the rebate from last year, so that's dropping, etc., etc., etc. And all of these issues may mean it's not viewed as cost-effective to do it. But you wouldn't at the moment see Mourinho being Spurs manager at the end of next season, would you? And the question is whether he's a manager at the start of next season. And I'm afraid at this juncture, if you'd asked me 2 months ago, I'd have said yes. Now the jury does appear to be more out.
It's a big 6 months that lies ahead of Tottenham Hotspur, it has to be said. And Jose Mourinho's proven time and again, if it isn't working out, he can make it a pretty toxic environment at a football club.
Yeah, it doesn't always work well for him when it falls apart. It doesn't always turn out badly, but it tends to.
Hmm.
Then again, if he burns too many bridges at Spurs and turns it into a really nasty scenario, who else would take him?
I think he's run out of road at this stage in terms of that upper echelon of club.
And what I would say is that over the first few, first year or so, he'd never behaved better at any club. Even when he was successful, he was picking fights.
Mm.
And he hadn't done that at Spurs. His behaviour was remarkably un-Mourinho-esque, as it were, in terms of him showing none of the sort of pettiness that's always been part of him, because even Mourinho at his best had the delight in causing ruck. He liked creative friction. Sometimes it was more than that. It was just an old-fashioned tear-up because he fancied it.
Hmm.
And he didn't do that at Tottenham for the first year. And to be fair, he hadn't done that in the poor period of games. He had a bit of a dig at the defending on Thursday, but he had every right to because they defended poorly. And you can argue about his tactics being poor or questionable, and that's different. People have their view. I don't know about that. They didn't play very well. But last night, he didn't dig anyone out, which he might have done, because that was a really shoddy performance. And he could have gone playing the blame game, and he chose not to, which I think is unusual, because normally you'd expect him to do that when things haven't gone well. So there is not the sort of madness that infested him during the dark days at United, when everyone knew it was falling apart and he was howling against the moon. And we haven't had that at Spurs yet.
Mm. Martin Lipton from Sun, thanks so much for speaking to us this evening.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Bye yourself. Football on Off the Ball. With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.